Hey folks, have you heard of cancer-fighting foods? The American Cancer Society discovered diets rich in fruits and vegetables may actually lower your risk of cancer. Think about that for a second. That's really important. Hopefully you hear this and run to the store for 5 servings of fruits and vegetables every day. But if you're like me, you probably don't have the time to do that, right? So maybe you should consider adding Field of Greens to your daily health regimen. Each fruit and veggie in Field of Greens was doctor selected for studied health benefits. There's a heart health group, lungs, kidneys, and metabolism groups, even healthy weight. What your body needs is in each scoop of delicious Field of Greens. I take it every day. Sometimes I put it in a shake. Sometimes I put it in my egg white omelet in the morning. Field of Greens can help prevent, treat, and cure cancer? No, but it can powerfully help you out at your next checkup. Your doctor will notice your improved health or you're going to get your money back. Here's the most amazing thing about it. I started using Field of Greens a year ago. My cholesterol is down, my blood sugar is down, my weight's down, my health is up, my sleeping patterns are better, my metabolism is up. If you want to experience what I've experienced, go check out Field of Greens. Jump into the ring here. You're going to get an enormous benefit. And it's so simple. Single scoop, a couple of seconds, healthy lifestyle all day long. Now, thanks to our good friends at Brickhouse Nutrition, Field of Greens is going to give you a 15% off discount plus free rush shipping. All you got to do is go to fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code JUSTNEWS for your discount. That's promo code JUSTNEWS at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com, promo code JUSTNEWS. Go check it out.
Hi, folks. Welcome back to the John Solomon Reports podcast. I'm your guest host, Ben Whedon. I'll be here with you today and tomorrow. I'm the evening editor at Just the News. Today, we're going to be talking to a former New York congressman who is now running for state assembly. This is a little bit of an unusual career path for politicians of any persuasion. And he has some interesting ideas on how the Republicans are going to gain ground both in the state legislature in Albany and in the congressional battles that are going to be fought in the November elections later this year. He's going to get into the detail of that after the break.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
All right, folks, welcome back from the break. I'm here with former New York Congressman Joe Sempolinski. He's running for state assembly in the 148th District in New York. Joe, great to have you with us.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, so why don't you go ahead and give us a little bit of an update on your campaign and what's going on with the battle for the legislature?
Well, it's going very well. The assembly district I'm running for is currently held by Assemblyman Joe Giglio. He's retiring at the end of his term. And that opened up the seat, and I decided to run for it. It's a little unusual. The media tells me that if I'm elected, I'll be the first person elected to the New York State Assembly who is a former member of the United States House of Representatives in 110 years. It's quite common to go the other way, but going from the U.S. House to the State Assembly is a little unusual. Obviously, my time in Congress was a little unusual. It was finishing off term, and then redistricting happened and what have you. So I will be the first member of the House going to the Assembly in a very long time, and I'm the second shortest tenured member of the House in the history of the state of New York. But it's a district that's a very rural, very Republican district. All of it was in the old congressional district that I represented. And so it sets up very well for me to be able to serve. And in the meantime, since I was in the U.S. House, what I've been doing is serving as the chief of staff for the current assemblyman, Mr. Giglio. And so I'm about as prepared as anyone can be to do that particular job. I'm looking forward to it. And certainly we need more voices in Albany that are not just saying what needs to be done perhaps in New York City, but also considers that this is a very large state with a very diverse set of needs. And sometimes the policies that come from our friends in the Democratic Party don't take into account all of those diverse needs. You know, what happens in Olean or Wellsville, New York is very different than perhaps the way of life in the Bronx or Brooklyn.
Well, you certainly seem like you have a pretty strong pathway to making up into Albany this cycle. But as you did just point out, it is a much broader statewide set of contests that are going to shape control of the legislature. You know, New York has been a largely Democratic-leaning state for quite a while. So there's going to be a lot more across the state. And as I remember, you were a vice chair in the Finger Lakes region for the New York Republican Party. So can you tell me a little bit about, you know, how they're looking at these contests across the state and what they think their prospects are for making gains in the chambers?
Yeah, so that's correct. I'm the Finger Lakes Regional Vice Chair for the New York State Party. In the Assembly and Senate, there's really good chance to break the two-thirds supermajorities that the Democrats have. The Republicans are one seat short of getting above the threshold you would need to make sure they don't have two-thirds. In the Senate, we would need three seats in the Assembly. That's very doable. There's certainly seats that both the Assembly and Senate Republicans will be going after. They obviously get as close as you can to try and break the majorities. The Senate mathematically is a little easier just because it's smaller, so you need fewer seats themselves to get close to that. The big ticket item, of course, in New York State is going to be the seats in the U.S. House. You can make a very strong argument, and I would make that argument, that the current majority was built in New York State. And certainly, if it's going to be retained, it's going to be retained in New York State. So there's going to be a lot of interesting races at the state legislative and at the U.S. House level throughout New York State, and certainly I have to take care of business on the home front. I do have a general election. I don't have a primary. I am the Republican nominee for the state assembly in the district in which I'm running, but as best I can, I'll certainly be fulfilling my role as a party leader to try and help those other candidates, Assembly, Senate, and Congress, especially throughout upstate New York, as best I can.
Okay. So you brought up the argument that the House majority, the current very narrow one, was built in New York State. There was a fairly lengthy redistricting battle ahead of the 2022 midterms, and people widely credit the way that map turned out with actually handing Republicans several additional seats that put them over the top. You've also seen people talk about Lee Zeldin's, you know, very near successful campaign for governor helping to push them over the edge there too. But those districts have since been changed due to a lot of legal back and forth over the redistricting panel and some lawsuits. How do you all feel about your prospects with regards to these being changed by the Democrats in the legislature?
Yeah, it's been quite a long odyssey in how the districts were drawn. We had a constitutional amendment come into place a few years ago that put in place a independent redistricting commission. However, it did not give the redistricting commission the final say. The commission would produce a map and then send it to the legislature for approval or disapproval, and the legislature still had the final determinative say over what the map would be. So what happened was the commission produced the map, the legislature rejected it, the legislature put in place their own map. We thought that was going to be the map in 2022. All the ballot access happened with that map as far as the petitioning process, which is very technical and onerous in the state of New York. Then there was a successful lawsuit, which was brought in Steuben County, where I live, and where I'm the Republican chairman in Steuben County. And that lawsuit was ultimately the result of it, at the trial level was ultimately upheld by the Court of Appeals, the highest court in the state of New York, which threw the legislative map out. At that point, a special master was appointed and drew the map that, as you described, led to a large number of seats being picked up in New York State during the midterm election. Then what happened was the Democrats brought a lawsuit saying, well, the Constitution says you're supposed to have a second map be sent to the legislature. That never happened. Therefore, the technicalities weren't observed. Therefore, we need to have a new map. And that case was successful. The commission produced a second map, which was basically the map that the special master had drawn with some tweaks. The tweaks were mostly to help the Democrats, but they were not major changes. As was expected, the legislature then rejected this second map from the commission because it was, most people believe, the lawsuit, while it was saying, oh, we have to follow the rules and have a second map produced and what have you, it was just an excuse to get the legislature to get another crack at it. But then what was a little unexpected was once the legislature got the pen in their hands again, and remember, as I said in the answer to the last question, the Democrats control supermajorities, and the provisions of the state constitution force supermajoritarian margins to approve a map. The legislative map did move things in the direction of the Democrats, but again, only another small margin. So basically the map that we are operating on now is an edit to an edit of the special master map. And the feeling is that the Democrats felt sort of gun shy for getting burned in 22, where they lost the lawsuit that produced the special master map. Also, as I mentioned, their supermajoritarian numbers are right on the edge. And so you could only force the map as aggressively as a gerrymander as the most marginal Democrats were willing to go, because if you start losing one senator or three assembly members, you couldn't force the new map into law. So we were expecting, as Republicans in New York, this dramatic change in the districts going into the 24 once the Democrats won this most recent lawsuit. And instead, we got a little bit of a tweak. And because of that, there doesn't appear to be any call for subsequent litigation. It looks like this new map will be the map. And, you know, there are marginal changes. The district I live in, you know, there's another county added on and some pieces of other counties that get changed, but not wholesale changes. So we will fight the House elections in 2024 in New York State on a map that is very similar, though slightly in the favor of the Democrats, to the one that we fought in 2022. The difference, of course, being last time the gubernatorial race was the top of the ticket, and this time the presidential race will be the top of the ticket. And obviously that produces turnouts that are different, dynamics that are different. But all in all, I think a lot of Republicans in New York are pleasantly surprised that they are still in the game in all of the districts that they thought they were that they were in the game for last time, even if that game may be a slightly tilted against them compared to 2 years ago.
Okay, so the party's still pretty optimistic that they'll be fighting these battle lines on, you know, familiar ground going into the 2024 election. All right, folks, we will be back right after this break. Don't go anywhere.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
All right, folks, we're back here with former New York Congressman Joe Sempulinski, currently running for the State Assembly. We've been talking about the Republican prospects in the Empire State come 2024. And we recently, right before we got off of break, we're talking about the redistricting lines and the U.S. House prospects for the party. One of the races in one of the districts that was most affected by some of this, legislative and legal wrangling over these municipal lines was the district that George Santos won in 2022. That district was a competitive district that was previously held by a Democrat who wasn't seeking re-election. Tom Suozzi had challenged Kathy Hochul. And so the seat was open. George Santos managed to win, flipping the district for the Republicans. And that seat is now back in the hands of Tom Suozzi, who filled it in a special election. But that vacancy was the result of the House choosing to expel George Santos. Well, the Republicans did so largely at the at the behest of a lot of New York Republicans in the House. So one thing I want to ask Congressman Sempulinski is, how would you have voted? Was this a mistake? We're certainly seeing a lot of tied votes that have been popping up lately.
Yeah, there was certainly some discussion about that regarding the FISA votes in recent days. My concern with the Santos votes is the fact that he had not yet been convicted. I mean, most of the discussion has been surrounding the political ramifications. Obviously, the Republicans have a very slim majority, and having one fewer Republican affects legislation, affects what's able to go through, what's not able to go through, what will go through, what the agenda will be. Certainly, there were as you mentioned, Republicans in New York, whose concern was that you had this very controversial, now indicted on very serious charges figure that they would have to, be constantly asked questions about going into the 2024 election. I certainly sympathize with that. But, my concern regarding the Santos expulsion would be more along the lines of, what precedent does it set? This is the first time that somebody's been expelled from the House of Representatives who, where the person has not been convicted of a crime yet and didn't take up arms against the federal government because there were Confederates in the 1800s that were expelled. So that would be more my concern with expelling Santos at the time he was expelled. Certainly if he had been convicted of the crimes of which he's been accused, of which there's a lot of evidence for, I'd feel differently. But the timing, given we're only dealing with indictments, and there are penalties for being indicted. When you are indicted for a felony, the House rules already say you lose your committee assignments. So it's not like somebody goes without sanction if they're indicted. That is my concern with the expulsion is now somebody down the road uses that as a precedent for somebody that is indicted but not convicted of a crime.
Now, his absence or expulsion was only one of the factors contributing to the shrinking Republican majority. We've seen a number of representatives indicate they're not going to run for re-election, and a few that simply left early. In fact, that's how you got in. You had Tom Reed representing the 23rd district at the time, resigned before his term was ended, and you took a special election. But we are seeing a few that have decided to do so just a little bit too late to avoid a special election, and one who may have done so for the purpose of causing one and maybe stifling a re-election chance by someone who's running in his district. I'm, of course, referring to Ken Buck and Lauren Boebert, who's running for re-election there. How do you feel about people leaving early? Is this just giving up? Is there merit to this?
Yeah, obviously every resignation is different and everybody has the decisions they make. However, I served 112 days in the House of Representatives. And That's a very unusual amount of time. And I had a lot of people, the media, public, folks in D.C., you know, well, why would you run if you're only going to serve that period of time? And I said in my inauguration speech, which is one of the few perks of being elected in a special election, you get an inauguration speech, that, you know, I would have served for 4 minutes. I would have gone through the whole thing for that amount of time, because serving in the House is a profound honor, whether you're in leadership or not, whether you're in the majority or not, whether you're there for a short time or a long time. And so I do get distressed when people leave early. And I say that even as somebody who's a beneficiary of somebody else leaving early. You have every right to choose not to run for re-election. You know, that certainly is somebody's prerogative. If they want to say, hey, listen, I'm not running again, I'm just going to finish my term, you know, that happens all the time. That's certainly completely legitimate. But it's when people sort of throw up their hands and say, oh, I want to go, that I think is disrespectful to the institution, because, you know, really, it's an honor to be a rank and file member. You're speaking for 750,000 people, and anything that diminishes that, I think, is corrosive to our constitutional order. And also, just think of the blood that's been spilled throughout all of the wars that America has fought for their freedom. Americans have fought for their freedom to have a representative form of government, and something that most people in history have not had. So, you know, use an example. I would say, you know, being the congressman from Bakersfield, California, is an honor, even if you're not Speaker of the House anymore, to use former Representative McCarthy as an example. So I would encourage somebody, if they want to do something else with their life, then feel free. But I would say, if you've been elected to a term, barring some sort of health crisis or something like that, I would say the appropriate thing is for somebody to finish their term, show respect to the institution, show respect to the constitutional order, and respect to the voters that have given you that time. And I took 112 days, every second of it, very seriously. And I did it as a minority member in the lower house and the most junior member of the House. And it was still a profound honor to be there. I would ask everybody to think about the office in that way.
Well, you brought up the change in speakers with McCarthy being ousted. I follow you on social media. I remember when Mike Johnson actually got chosen, you put out a post recalling that he was one of the first people to really reach out to you when you showed up. And so you had been fairly well acquainted with the guy at the time. He's certainly facing some trouble now in a very narrow majority, and now two lawmakers saying that they're going to back a motion to vacate. You know, he's certainly faced a difficult situation with this narrow majority and a lot of key votes, be it budget, foreign aid, or FISA at the moment. You know, how does he navigate this? You know, I believe you're familiar with most of these lawmakers in question here. They all overlapped with you for a while, Massey, Green, and everybody. You know, there's certainly a lot of split, you know, agenda even within the Republican Party. You know, how do people navigate that? How, you know, what is his path for dealing with this kind of thing, do you think?
It's a tough job. And I think the amount of people that sort of rose and fell prior to Speaker Johnson becoming Speaker Johnson shows how difficult it is to do this job, because you've got to hold together a majority with a extremely small margin for error. And the reason that the current speaker got the job is some of the attributes that I described in the post that you're referencing. What that post mentioned was, you know, I think it was my first or second day in the House. And at the time, Mr. Johnson was the conference vice chair. So he was in charge of internal messaging. You know, what are we going to talk about in our floor speeches this week? It's going to be immigration, or it's going to be transportation, or, you know, whatever it is. And, you know, he approached me on the floor, and obviously I knew the conference chair very well because she's from New York, Ms. Stefanik, and she'd been very supportive of my campaign, being a New Yorker. But I had not, you know, had a chance to meet Mr. Johnson from Louisiana as of yet. And he sought me out, approached me, and said, "Hey, listen, I want to, you know, let you know we're all happy you're here." Obviously, which was nice to hear given my unusual circumstances, and you know that all the resources of the conference are available to you, and this is who I am, and you know, it's nice to meet you, and we had a nice, very pleasant chat, and he invited me to, be part of the life of that group, and I think that demeanor. And certainly that was reinforced during conference meetings while I was there when he would present, sort of self-effacing, positive, friendly person. This is a guy that really doesn't have a lot of enemies coming in to being the speaker. And I think that's why he got the job. But that demeanor doesn't make the job any easier. And I would hope that people realize that it would be very damaging to go through another vacancy. That is not going to be something that's going to advance conservative policy. That's not something that's going to be advanced the electoral prospects of the Republican Party. It's not something that's going to be good for the institution. So if you want to have a discussion about whether Mr. Johnson should be the leader of the Republican conference next Congress, then certainly that's a discussion that could be had. And it's something that should be had every 2 years, no matter who the leader is. But now I would say, the choice has been made. Let's give him the ability to do that job for good or for ill for the remainder of the Congress.
All right. Well, I'd like to circle back to your race and some of the statewide stuff. You've mentioned at the start of the program that you see a real opportunity to break the legislative supermajorities that the Democrats have in both chambers up in Albany. As I understand it, breaking that two-thirds threshold would give you guys access to the filibuster again and the ability to actually get some more tangible input on the legislation. You know, assuming that actually happens, you're able to get over those thresholds. You know, what's going to be on the docket? What are the priorities for the GOP in the state?
Yeah, I think some of the procedural things that you'd be able to do if you get over that two-thirds is then you're able to sort of play the governor off against the legislature because they can't override her veto and these sort of things. One of the dynamics that's happened increasingly so in Albany is the rise of a very extreme elements of the Democratic Party. And so you have, if you're I can't get inside Speaker Hastie's head, but I would imagine a more imminent threat to his agenda is some of his own members on the far left more than the Republican Party. So there may be opportunities to sort of triangulate and deal with certain elements of the Democratic majorities who are concerned about more radical elements. There may be opportunities to play the governor off against the legislature. But as far as positive agenda, some of the biggest concerns are, one, the level of crime and the level of changes of policy that have led to benefiting criminals over victims, so-called bail reform, so-called discovery reform. That's something where I think there's real opportunities electorally in the outer boroughs of New York City. We have currently members of the State Assembly in the Republican conference from Queens and Brooklyn that we haven't had in a very long time. We can, I think, grow that success that we had in 22 from the Zeldin campaign on down in the outer boroughs. And if you do that, the math starts to change pretty quickly as far as legislative majorities and as far as statewide offices. There's also just the raw level of spending. New York State has a smaller population than Texas. New York State has a smaller population than Florida, yet we spend more than those two states put together every year. Now, that is an unsustainable path, especially with the post-COVID mobility of workers, especially high-earning workers who can increasingly do their job from anywhere in the world. That fundamentally challenges the fiscal model of the state of New York, which is based on large bonuses being taxed from in the financial sector. If those folks can do their job from anywhere, you know, they're going to increasingly do so. So quality of life issues regarding the economy, quality of life issues regarding law and order, I think are what you're going to see the focus continue to be from the Republican conference in the state assembly and the Republican conference in the New York State Senate.
All right. Well, certainly sounds like things to be looking forward to up in November. Folks, Joe Sempalinski, thank you for being with us here today.
That's a real pleasure.
We will be back after this break, and don't go anywhere.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
All right, folks, welcome back from the break. That was Joe Sempalinski, New York, former New York congressman, now running for state assembly. He certainly had some interesting ideas, and the Republicans appear poised to at least pick up a few gains in the Empire State coming in November. During our discussion, we briefly touched on the woes facing House Speaker Mike Johnson, who has faced a motion to vacate, which is a formal procedural term for removing him from his speaker's post, from Marjorie Taylor Greene. She's a conservative firebrand who brought this motion before Congress went on recess, citing her frustrations with Johnson's handling of budget negotiations. Remember, Johnson passed a stopgap bill. They were calling it a minibus, which effectively split the 12 annual appropriations bills into two six-bill packages to fund the government in stages. Republicans have been largely frustrated with this and the means by which they were supposed to secure budget cuts. Green, since she got back, has circulated a letter criticizing Johnson and really citing quite a few issues that she has with him. But until now, she's been standing alone in calling for his removal. Well, Kentucky Republican Rep. Thomas Massie came out today and said that he would support Green's motion to get rid of Johnson. Massie is a generally libertarian-leaning member of Congress who has been a vocal critic of the FISA surveillance powers that the House just voted to extend, and of Johnson's handling of the budget, as well as a new package that has been announced to provide foreign aid to a number of foreign countries. Johnson this week came out with a plan to introduce four separate pieces of legislation to independently fund Ukraine, Israel, Taiwan, and to put forward a fourth miscellaneous package that includes apparently a TikTok ban, a means of seizing the Russian oligarch's assets and sending them to Ukraine, and a few other security priorities. Well, all of those are on Massey's no list, so he's got good reason for joining in with Green at this point. It remains to be seen whether Johnson himself will be able to navigate that internal dissent within his caucus. He certainly had trouble with that so far. But with more Republicans jumping onto this motion to vacate, it's going to be harder for him to hold the post. It's going to put more pressure on him to change his way of handling things. And it's going to mean that if there actually is a vote, he's going to need more Democrats to come in and keep him in office, which is certainly not going to look very good from a Republican standpoint. So we'll see how he manages to navigate that. On a somewhat unrelated note, we also had a federal appeals court case today overturn West Virginia's transgender sports ban. Like many states, almost half of them in the country, West Virginia had a ban on transgender athletes from participating in women's sports. There's been a fairly large push to keep women's sports as a women-only space. There have been arguments that these athletes have an unfair competitive advantage. And that case is now almost certainly going to go to the Supreme Court, which incidentally, earlier this week, allowed Ohio's ban on certain gender transition treatments for minors to actually take effect. Now, that's not a final ruling. It's the lifting of a stay that's going to let it take effect while there is litigation going through the lower courts. But we're at a point where 25 states, about, you know, give or take, have passed either a gender treatment ban for minors or a transgender sports ban. Some have done one and not the other, but we are more or less at about half, and we should expect to see this kind of litigation play out across the country
until the court gives some final blessing to either one of those. Incidentally, the court is now facing an entirely unrelated matter involving the January 6th protesters. Today, the justices are hearing arguments on an obstruction charge in Fisher versus the United States. Obstruction is one of the charges that the DOJ has been bringing against a lot of January 6th protesters. It certainly has some implications for Donald Trump, who does face such charges in his D.C. election case. But the Supreme Court's likely to have an even more significant ruling on that in the near future, because on April 25th, they're going to hear arguments over Trump's claims to enjoy presidential immunity. Trump himself will not be at those arguments because of a ruling from New York Judge Merchant, who is overseeing Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg's case against Donald Trump for falsifying business records, allegedly. That case pertains to a 2016 payment that Trump's then attorney made to Stormy Daniels. Trump's denied any wrongdoing and contends that this case is part of a broader political witch hunt. We'll see how that plays out. The trial started on Monday and is going expected to continue for quite a while. Trump, meanwhile, is facing a longer battle to try to get some of these days during that trial to go somewhere else. He wants to go to his son's high school graduation. He was denied going to the Supreme Court arguments, but we'll see if he's able to get any more time off and perhaps even hit the campaign trail. All right, folks, that's everything for us today. Again, I'm Ben Whedon, guest host. I'm the evening editor at Just the News, and I'll be with you tomorrow as well, so come back again.